Welcome to this ePrimary Care Review podcast. I'm Bob Busker, managing editor of ePrimary Care Review. We're here today with Dr. Nehru Pucha, assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, to discuss how some of the newer developments in COPD management that she analyzed in her recent newsletter issue can be applied in the exam room. ePrimary Care Review is presented by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. This program is supported by an educational grant from Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Incorporated. Learning objectives for this audio program include: explain how the GOLD recommendations can help guide therapy in individuals with COPD, and describe potential treatment options beyond LAMA, LABA, and inhaled corticosteroids. Dr. Pucha has disclosed that she has no relationship with any product or service relevant to today's discussion. She has also indicated that she will not be referencing the unlabeled or unapproved use of any product or service relevant to today's discussion, with the exception of brief mention of meprilizumab and benralizumab for the treatment of eosinophilic COPD. Dr. Pucha, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
In your newsletter issue, Doctor, you analyzed the recent advances in personalized care in COPD management, including, among other things, revisions to the GOLD guidance, the importance of eosinophil levels, telehealth pulmonary rehab programs, and potential treatments beyond standard triple therapy. Our focus today is to put some of that new information into clinical context. So let me ask you to start us out, if you would please, Doctor, with a patient scenario.
Ms. B is a 64-year-old woman who recently established care in your clinic and now presents for follow-up about dyspnea. She is a former smoker, 40 pack years, and quit 3 years ago when she was hospitalized for pneumonia. In the past few years, she has noted progressive dyspnea on exertion, and at this point, she is feeling it on a daily basis. She notes she is now feeling dyspneic with walking for just a few minutes, even without an incline or stairs, and she cannot carry heavy loads. At your first visit, you had ordered lung function tests, and these show an obstructive pattern, with her post-bronchodilator FEV1 at 45% predicted. You also ordered labs, and it is noted on a CBC that she has 5% peripheral eosinophils with an absolute count of 400. She also notes having some seasonal allergic rhinitis symptoms, itchy eyes, runny nose, and postnasal drip in the spring and fall. Since her hospitalization a few years ago, she's not had any additional hospitalizations, ER visits, or unscheduled doctor visits for breathing. She asks you for a diagnosis and for medications to treat her symptoms.
Well, let's start with what she's asking you for, a diagnosis. What are your initial thoughts?
So she has symptoms consistent with COPD, and her PFT support that diagnosis. But in some cases with patients like this, given that common diseases like cardiovascular disease have shared risk factors with COPD, I would consider asking some more detailed questions about chest pain and consider whether a good workup for coronary artery disease or congestive heart failure is necessary.
So let's assume you question her and her answers convince you that you can rule out cardiovascular conditions. So that's going to lead you to confirm a diagnosis of COPD. What happens next?
So the next step would be to use the severity of her symptoms and history of exacerbations and assign her GOLD symptom category score. In this case, she has moderate to severe dyspnea, which on the Modified Medical Research Council dyspnea scale, she has a 3, and that's recommended to be assessed by GOLD guidelines, and no history of exacerbations in the past year. So she's a GOLD symptom category B. From here, you can figure out the initial treatment plan.
Well, figuring out that initial treatment plan, step us through that, if you would, please.
Sure. So the initial treatment plan for a patient like this would be to give the patient a single long-acting bronchodilator, either a long-acting beta agonist or a long-acting anticholinergic. We call these LABA or LAMA. Along with this, you could provide a short-acting bronchodilator to be used as needed. It's important to also give education on the use of these inhalers at the time of your visit. There are several types of devices with different delivery methods, and not all are intuitive. Education when you start a new inhaler or change inhalers is very important.
LABA or LAMA, a short-acting bronchodilator, that all seems pretty straightforward. But let me ask you, are there any other treatment strategies you might consider in a patient like this?
So this patient also meets criteria for lung cancer screening. Though this is not a screening tool unique to patients with COPD, it's important to think about this in our COPD patients since the vast majority of them are current and former smokers. Other treatment strategies really depend on her degree of response to the treatment and on follow-up whether she's having symptoms or exacerbations on the treatment you gave. Exacerbations are important to look out for, and I counsel all my patients on the types of symptoms to look out for with regards to exacerbations so that we can appropriately manage these events.
Well, exacerbations. Let me follow up on that with a hypothetical. Let's say that you see this patient 3 months later, and she tells you she's been to the emergency room 3 times for breathing problems, and she was even hospitalized during one of those visits. How does that change what you're doing?
Yeah, so this is an important issue to recognize in patients with COPD, to know when they're hospitalized or visit ERs with flares of their disease or acute exacerbations. First, I would get a thorough history to understand what, if anything, has changed that could have contributed to this increase in exacerbations. Is there a new environmental trigger? Is there an indolent infection we're missing? Or a lung mass that's causing recurrent pneumonia? Next, I would determine how to potentially change treatment.
What do the GOLD recommendations say in this case?
So the GOLD recommendations suggest that for those on a single long-acting bronchodilator like our patients, that if they're suffering exacerbations and treatment, that they can be escalated to add the second bronchodilator, a LABA with a LAMA, or that an inhaled corticosteroid with LABA can be prescribed, particularly in those patients who are recognized to have higher levels of eosinophils, like our patient. This represents a recent change in GOLD that has largely come about due to the expanding literature base showing higher benefit for exacerbation reduction using inhaled corticosteroids in those with more eosinophils, which is reflected in some of the manuscripts we reviewed for the newsletter.
Well, let me continue with that hypothetical, if you don't mind. With exacerbations, with hospitalizations, would you also consider referring this patient to pulmonary rehab?
Yes, that's a great point. At this point, we could argue that there are really multiple indications for pulmonary rehab in this patient, including her severe exercise limitation, which is not improved with inhalers, and her frequent exacerbations. She's an ideal candidate for pulmonary rehab at this point. Also, I would review inhaler technique again and screen for other common comorbidities like cardiovascular disease and anxiety and depression.
Are there other potential interventions to consider in this patient? And I'm asking this because in your newsletter issue, you reviewed the current literature on bronchoscopic lung volume reduction procedures. In this hypothetical situation we've been talking about, would you consider that to be an option for this patient?
That's a good question. There are other things to consider in these patients. There are some studies showing utility of education for self-management techniques to help patients better manage their disease and symptoms at home, and recognize early signs of exacerbation to facilitate early treatment and avoid hospitalization. Some studies have shown value in efforts to increase physical activity in such patients as well. However, I would not really consider this patient candidate for bronchoscopic lung volume reduction at this time. This procedure is intended for people with severe exercise limitation, which our patient has, but the patients studied in the trial such as Liberate, which we reviewed in the newsletter issue, were relatively stable from the standpoint of exacerbations. The average number of hospitalizations for exacerbations in the past year for both arms of the Liberate trial were less than 1, 0.4 and 0.3 in both arms.
Thank you for clearing that up, Doctor. I also want to ask you about considering a biologic targeted treatment for eosinophilic COPD. In a patient with exacerbations and hospitalizations, might that be appropriate?
Yeah, so with treatment of eosinophilic COPD and things such as mepolizumab and benralizumab, the study we reviewed in the newsletter showed little effect of adding benralizumab for people who are maximally treated for COPD, arguing against this approach. For mepolizumab, although the studies were mixed, FDA does not currently support the approach until further studies better establish the clear definition of eosinophilic COPD and the clear efficacy of such treatment within this group.
I want to ask you about one more hypothetical, Doctor. Let's say your patient is on triple therapy, LABA, LAMA, and an inhaled corticosteroid, and she's doing well on it. Her PFT numbers are steady and no exacerbations for the past 6 months. Now, she comes to you and says she wants to try cutting down her medications. She wants to discontinue her inhaled corticosteroid, discontinue her LAMA, and try to get by with the LABA agent alone. Would you consider this an acceptable strategy?
This is an important question, and that clinically comes up in the care of these patients, and we really should always keep asking ourselves this question. Inhaled corticosteroids are usually well-tolerated, but there is data showing increased risk for pneumonia with long-term use, and their use really should balance the risk and benefit. However, recent studies of either step-down strategies or removal of ICS in patients on triple inhaled therapy have shown that results can be mixed. Also, as we saw in the SUNSET study that we reviewed in the newsletter, there should be some caution in patients with higher levels of eosinophils, like in our patient. At this point, I would think it would be too soon to stop her ICS, but I would continue to follow her and watch for a longer period for stability, and then we can reassess.
Thank you for sharing your insights, Doctor. And we'll return with Dr. Nehru Pucha from Johns Hopkins in just a moment. You've been listening to a Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine ePrimary Care Review podcast. We're a combination newsletter and podcast continuing educational series focused specifically on information important to primary care providers. We're available online without cost or prerequisite. ePrimary Care Review newsletters focus on a specific area of importance to the care of patients presenting to primary care. Each newsletter is authored by an expert clinician who reviews the current literature and provides commentary and analysis. The podcasts are case-based discussions, like the one you've been listening to, focused on experts translating the new information from the newsletter into clinical practice. Continuing education credit for ePrimary Care Review is provided by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. For more information about ePrimary Care Review, please go to our website, epcpreview.org. And if you've enjoyed this podcast and found the information useful, please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts so that others can find it as well. Thank you. Welcome back to this ePrimary Care Review podcast. We've been speaking with Dr. Nehru Pucha from the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine about how some of the new information she analyzed in a recent newsletter issue can be applied to clinical practice. So, Doctor, let's continue in that vein, and if you would please, bring us another patient scenario.
Okay. Mr. C is a 76-year-old with history of COPD for many years who presents for a follow-up visit with you. He quit smoking about 5 years ago and is currently on dual bronchodilator therapy, that's LABA and LAMA. Despite this, he still has severe exercise limitation. He describes dyspnea with minimal activity, like dressing and bathing. Last year, he was started on oxygen and uses this both at rest and with exertion. His recent FEV1 is 30% predicted, and he has significant gas trapping with a residual volume of 184% predicted on lung volume. He has never been noted to have eosinophils on his CBC, and he has not had an exacerbation or pneumonia for the past 3 years.
Where is this patient in relation to the GOLD categories, and what does the guidance recommend?
So this patient is a GOLD symptom category B patient, and he is currently on dual bronchodilator therapy. The GOLD strategy suggests that in these patients, there is not really a role for inhaled corticosteroids, especially without any history of exacerbations. GOLD would suggest here to switch inhaler devices. And I would also add that assessing inhaler technique to determine whether the inhaler interface is the right one for the patient also makes sense.
Just a quick sidebar here, Dr. Pucha. Here's a patient who presents with a history of COPD, but you're not the one who made that initial diagnosis. So how can you be certain that COPD is the only cause of his respiratory problems? What should a clinician do in this situation?
This is a patient in which a good workup for other causes of dyspnea is warranted. These patients should be considered and worked up for cardiac disease, including untreated ischemic heart disease, valvular heart disease, and congestive heart failure. Also, severe anemia should be considered.
Thank you for clarifying, Doctor. So let's assume you've done the workup and there are no signals for heart disease or anemia. What would be your next step with this patient?
So this is definitely a case in which there's a clear indication for pulmonary rehabilitation. There is a large body of evidence to support that approach in this patient and in those with severe exercise limitation and symptoms of dyspnea. The other patient population to consider rehab is those with frequent exacerbations. That is not this patient, but it's another indication to keep in mind. When I introduced the idea of rehabilitation to patients, we began to talk about the logistics as well. If they need to have the mobility paperwork filled out, we began to do this. And I asked them to plan in advance for the necessity to have transportation and availability to fully participate in the program.
If this patient is unable to manage transportation, would you try to enroll him in a video telehealth rehab program?
The study we looked at in the newsletter issue showed a significant reduction in readmissions in patients with COPD enrolled in video telehealth rehabilitation. However, this was not a randomized study, and the study population had different indications for rehab. They were hospitalized for COPD exacerbations. So one could assume that it could be efficacious in this population. We probably need randomized studies to confirm this. Also, we do not really currently have such a program at my institution, but if this is studied more and shown to be effective, it's a strategy that many centers may consider adopting in the future.
Time for another hypothetical, doctor. Let's say the patient completes a rehabilitation program, but still continues to be very limited in his ADLs. What would you suggest at this point?
So at that point, the patient may be a reasonable candidate for more advanced therapy, such as bronchoscopic lung volume reduction. Specifically, you think about this strategy in this patient because he has substantial air trapping, emphysema, and severe airflow obstruction. However, it's important to know that the workup for these procedures is extensive, and there is a reason for this. As was shown in the Liberate trial, which we reviewed in the newsletter issue, the population shown to have improvement from this procedure was really carefully selected. Patients who improved with this procedure were not obese. They did not require high doses of prednisone to maintain clinical stability, and they were not frequent exacerbators. Also, they were former smokers and had quit at least 4 months prior to starting the trial. The lung function testing for these patients showed significant gas trapping with a residual volume greater than 175% predicted, and they were not severely hypoxemic, nor did they have severe hypercapnia. They did not have active heart disease. After confirming these criteria are met, which is the case for our patient, he will need to have a CT scan showing certain characteristics, including intact fissures and a reasonable target lobar lobes with some heterogeneity or imbalance in the emphysema changes. Usually, this means that the other lobes in the same lung are more preserved than the target lobe. Also, there's an extensive procedure to help confirm that the target lobe does not have collateral ventilation. This is a very involved procedure with risks, but it can be worthwhile in a subset of patients who are well selected. It seems worthwhile to work up our patient and see if he would be a good candidate as long as he's aware that the workup will be exhaustive.
You've certainly described an exhaustive workup, but this is not something that's likely to happen within the boundaries of primary care, is it?
So this is not a procedure that is normally performed in the primary care setting. It's important to be aware of this option and the right subset of patients who would benefit as it becomes more available. These patients can then be referred to a local center experienced in performing the procedure.
Again, thank you for that clarification, Dr. Pooja. And thank you also for bringing us today's cases and discussion. I've got one more question for you, and it's future-oriented. Beyond everything we've talked about today, what do you think the next few years are going to hold for emerging COPD research?
There will be a push for more innovation in the realm of pulmonary rehabilitation with strategies similar to the telehealth program we discussed. We mentioned it today and reviewed it in more depth in the newsletter issue. These kinds of innovations help improve access to and uptake of pulmonary rehabilitation in COPD. There will also be more on the story of targeted treatment of eosinophilic COPD. There are many biologics that we are using to treat asthma, and though the early trials have been less exciting for COPD, the answer might be in developing better definitions of eosinophilic or allergic COPD and attempting to trial these medications in the right subset. That's a strategy which worked well for the bronchoscopic lung volume reduction interventions. There will also be, and currently is, a longer-term push to attempt to promote strategies that utilize precision medicine in COPD.
Thank you, Dr. Pooja, for sharing your insights. Let's wrap things up now by reviewing our discussion in light of our learning objectives. So to begin, our first learning objective, how the GOLD recommendations can help guide therapy in individuals with COPD. Doctor?
We covered a few points with regards to GOLD recommendations. First, GOLD recommendations now include checking serum eosinophil levels and using these values to help guide treatment in people with COPD, especially those at high risk for exacerbations. Case 1 demonstrated how eosinophil levels are now informing prescription of treatment, particularly inhaled corticosteroids in COPD. Next, there's no current role for targeted therapy, such as benralizumab in eosinophilic COPD. It's not FDA approved at this time, and it's not part of the GOLD recommendation. Also, removal of inhaled corticosteroids in individuals with COPD should be done with caution and should be a decision that is personalized for each patient. There's mixed evidence about the impact on exacerbations and lung function. Finally, One possible factor which may provide guidance in decision to remove ICS is the presence of serum eosinophils. Some studies have described higher risk for exacerbations in removal or withdrawal of ICS in people with higher serum eosinophil levels.
And our other learning objective, the potential treatment options beyond LAMA, LABA, and inhaled corticosteroids.
Bronchoscopic lung volume reduction is a promising new procedure which can be effective in improving exercise capacity and symptoms in well-selected individuals. People who are good candidates for bronchoscopic lung volume reduction need to be clinically stable and not have frequent exacerbations. These people should be selected to have little or no collateral ventilation, as determined by a very exhaustive pre-procedure protocol using imaging and, in some cases, bronchoscopy protocols. Pulmonary rehabilitation is a well-known program for individuals with COPD, and there is a great deal of evidence to support its use for improvement in a host of outcomes. Innovations in the delivery of pulmonary rehabilitation, including the possibility of using technology such as telehealth, seem to show some early promise in providing access to these programs for people who may be unable to attend in person, which is actually a large number of people.
Dr. Neeru Pucha from the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, thank you for participating in this ePrimary Care Review podcast.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you. It's been a pleasure.
For ePrimary Care Review, I'm Bob Busker. To receive CME credit for this activity, please take the post-test at epcpreview.org. This podcast is presented in conjunction with ePrimary Care Review Newsletter, a peer-reviewed literature review certified for CME credit, emailed monthly to clinicians treating patients presenting to primary care. This activity has been developed for clinicians diagnosing or managing patients presenting to primary care. There are no fees or prerequisites for this activity. The Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine designates this enduring material for a maximum of 0.5 AMA-PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in this activity. This educational resource is provided without charge, but registration is required. To register and receive ePrimary Care Review via email, please go to our website, epcpreview.org. The opinions and recommendations expressed by faculty and other experts whose input is included in this program are their own. This enduring material is produced for educational purposes only. Use of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine name implies review of educational format, design, and approach. Please review the complete prescribing information for specific drugs, combinations of drugs, or use of medical equipment, including indication, contraindications, warnings, and adverse effects before administering therapy to patients. ePrimary Care Review is supported by an educational grant from Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Incorporated. This program is copyright with all rights reserved by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Thank you for listening.